but how can we understand it more? How can we make it more relevant to our modern world? It's true that you are the Buddhist Society of Victoria is building a monastery for monks and nuns. Why do we need monks and nuns? Why do we need monasteries? Why do we need Buddhism? And the first thing to say is, whenever we are going to be helping share these incredible teachings, which I personally found so amazing, so wonderful, so true, so helpful in life, we've got to be very careful to please take all the cultural additions away from this, because I always remember a friend of mine who was a professor of physics at University of Western Australia, Professor David Brown, did many things with it. It's always very great to have dialogues between a Buddhist monk and a scientist. And in fact, with some of my friends over in Hong Kong, the Vice Chancellor of Cambridge, the Chancellor of Cambridge University recently visited a month ago, and they were pressuring him to get me to go and have a debate with Stephen Hawking, which would be really fun. Why not? Because I was a physicist before, now I'm a Buddhist, so actually I'm still a physicist. I'm a fifth Buddhist. which is very fascinating. And one of the things he often said to me is Professor David Blair, that when he was a young man, he was interested in the Buddhist teachings, and he went to Thailand to try and find out about Buddhism. But he could never get close enough to a Buddhist monk who actually knew what they're talking about to find out what Buddhism really was. All he ever saw was the bowing, the big statues, all the incense, and hardly anything else. And therefore he thought that Buddhism was just some superstitious tradition. The way I put it, you could never get close to the Buddha because of all the incense smoke, which was actually clouding what the teachings really are. So please be very careful. It's nice to have some ceremonies, but it's nice to know what those ceremonies really mean. Otherwise they become totally useless. And a good example of that, if ever you go to a Chinese temple, either here in Australia or overseas, your always point is these people, they take a whole bunch of incense and they go shaking it before they put it in the incense pot. When I first saw that, I couldn't really understand what was going on, because we never knew that. You could put some incense, you just put it in the pot. What are you shaking it for? And then I figured out, because whether it's in Sri Lanka or in Thailand, or especially in any sort of Chinese family, it's usually the job of the grandma to take the children to the temple the first time. And you start that in Sri Lanka all the time, and your grandparents take you to the temple, first of all. And what happened, I'm pretty sure, is grandma took the children to the temple, and grandma put the incense into the bottle and shook it. And the children did exactly the same, because they thought that's what needed to be done. But the reason why grandma shook that incense is because she had Parkinson's disease. And all her children did exactly the same, and now it's become the tradition, which is absolutely stupid. You don't need to do that. Just plug it in the thing if you really want to. Why do you need incense anyway? If you remember in those days, the people's hygiene wasn't all that good. And so you needed something like that to take away the smell, which makes it obvious why you use incense in those places. But in reality, you don't need to do that at all. Some of the stuff which we do, if we don't know the purpose behind it, I ask people, don't do it. Otherwise, again, Buddhism have just become a stupid tradition, a superstition, which has no meaning to people. And our children and other people will look at it and say it's just like any other religion, doing all of this the hocus pocus, mumbo jumbo, thinking that somehow or other you will go to heaven or whatever else. And of course, now to me, being a Buddhist, knowing Buddhism more deeply than that, it feels so sad that people, don't actually get to the heart of this beautiful tradition and see its great benefits in all sorts of areas of people's lives. And so please look at the traditions and find out what's really going on there. Even like bowing to a Buddha statue. Sometimes people ask me, especially in Western countries, Australians, what the hell are you doing just bowing to a Buddha statue? What do you do that for? My answer is that when you bow to a Buddha statue, especially if you bow often, it exercises your tummy muscles and then you don't get so fat. It's very good exercise when people eat so much these days. Of course, I should do more bowing, but that's my own problem, not yours. That's the joke, but When I bowed to a Buddha statue, I trained myself for this many years ago. The first time I bow, I don't bow to a statue because a statue is just a lump of metal, a lump of wood. I bow, obviously, to what it represents to me. And what the Buddha statue represents to me is this symbol of virtue, peace and compassion. It's one of the reasons why we have Buddha statues in people's gardens. It's the most famous ornament you'll find in anybody's house in Australia, especially in their garden, the Buddha statues, even in their houses. Why do they have that? Some years ago, I gave a talk in a Christian school, an Anglican school in Perth, and after the talk, the headmaster, the principal, asked me to have tea in his study. He wasn't there to punish me for saying something wrong. I got called to the headmaster's study. He was to have a nice cup of tea. And as we were talking, I noticed on his desk, there was a Buddha statue. Not a statue of Christ. There was nothing Christian in his study at all. And I recommended, what have you got a statue of the Buddha here? This is a Christian school. No, do your governors know about this? And he said, no, it just makes me feel peaceful. Exactly. It has an aura about it. It has a message. It means something to people. And you may not know this, but the British wartime Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, had a Buddha statue next to his bed for the whole duration of the Second World War. And we know this because if you go into his country house in UK, Chartwell, as you go in, by the entrance door, you'll see a painting of that Buddha statue, which was a Burmese-style Buddha statue. And if you ask the curator said that that Buddha statue actually broke. But before it broke, Winston Churchill painted a picture of that Buddha statue. And now that's on the wall. It was a painting of the original, which he had next to his bed throughout that time. Why would an English Prime Minister, who wasn't Buddhist at all, have such a statue there? And you can obviously figure out why, because during that time he really did need some sort of support, some peace, some inspiration during a very, very difficult time. We all know that he suffered from depression as well, as you could well imagine, fighting a war on which the well-being of his country and many other things depended. Very often came very close to losing that war, and fighting going for many years. So many people being bombed, being killed, being wounded. He was responsible for all of that. You really do need a huge amount of support, and on the top, you're by himself. A little Buddha statue by his bedside gave him that support and help. Fascinating. Why? And again, because it's an image which does give us peace and hope and compassion and inspiration. So, when I bow to a Buddha statue, I remember those things. The first time I bow, I actually bow to virtue, to goodness. Because in my life as a monk, life as a human being, I've just really been inspired by good people, by trustworthy people. People you can depend upon. People who don't take drink. I told the story the other day of just one terrible incident when a drunk driver slammed into a Chinese girl who had just finished her degree, single child from Chinese parents in mainland China. Chinese parents had just come over to migrate and now they were totally set adrift. The thing which they'd invested all of their lives in, their daughter, had now been mown down by a drunk driver. Sometimes we think, alcohol doesn't matter, but it does matter. And so, why do you do these things? When I was even a student, I gave up alcohol. You all know I went to Cambridge. It was supposed to be a smart, wise place. But if you really are intelligent, you will always question. You even question wisdom, which says there's a lot of intelligent people in that great university. There's a lot of stupid people there. And I know that because every year they would have the scholars' dinner. I wasn't just a laureate member, I was a scholar at Cambridge, which was in the top 10%. And every year you'd have this dinner, just for the 10% of top students and all of the professors, a couple of whom were Nobel laureates. These were supposed to be really smart people. But At that dinner, I remember it was a 9-course meal. Before we started the meal, we went into the old gallery, which was designed by Sir Christopher Wren. My college was Emmanuel, Emma, we used to call it. And there was butlers. I mean, this is real English butlers in coats and tails, highly trained, serving sherry. Now, not just ordinary sherry, this was the top bottles from the cellars, which they collected over the years. And the butlers were going around the tables in a clockwise direction. At that time, I was studying mathematics. And so with a friend, we soon worked out, if we go at the same speed in an anti-clockwise direction, we will meet the butler twice every circuit rather than once, thereby getting twice as much sherry as our friends. That's what a young person thinks. And so that's what we did. And after the sherry, we went to the old hall where we had our 9-course meal with a different wine for every course. And as those wine glasses, if they did get half empty, they were filled immediately with its butlers hovering behind you. And after the 9-course meal with I don't know how many glasses of wine, then we went into the old library where we had 3 glasses, one for port, one for Madeira, and one for claret, and 3 different types of intoxicating wines, which again were always kept full, with cigars and fruit on the tables. And then there was this huge goblet passed around, which was silver and encrusted with jewels, worth a fortune. It was a college heirloom. It's a rich place in Cambridge. That was filled with claret. And I don't know how big it is, but it must be over a litre, probably 2 litres. And every student and every professor had to drain it. And Sartre would say a toast in Latin, of course. And of course, no one could really pronounce Latin by that time. And it was supposed to be one of the highlights of the social calendar in the college. And I got so drunk, I don't remember how I ever got from that room back to my bedroom. But I did, and I woke up in the morning with a pile of vomit on my pillow. And that was disgusting. I didn't know at the time that that was dangerous. You could kill yourself choking on your own vomit when you're drunk. And I was so disgusted that that was the last time I ever took any alcohol. And afterwards I thought, what on earth are these people doing? They're supposed to be intelligent. Why do you do that? You don't need to take alcohol or drugs to have a good time. And having given up alcohol, I always thought that I'm in big trouble socially. Who wants to invite me to their parties? But I found I got invited to even more parties once my friends found out I'd given up alcohol. Because they wanted someone sober to drive them home, and that was me. So I got all these great invites to the parties. And not only that, you know, I'm being honest, like I was a young man, like girls. And I always remembered when I used to take alcohol and get drunk, the best part of a party, you know, when you found a girl and you were in the corner, you know, canoodling, if you want to call it that. Now, when I didn't have alcohol, I was perfectly aware. My mindfulness was very strong. I enjoyed it. But when I was drunk, I didn't know what I was doing. You missed the best part. It's stupid getting drunk. Or even taking any alcohol. You just really wanted to be awake and aware and enjoy yourself. So that's the last time I actually did those things. And so even a little thing like, you know, not drinking alcohol, which is such a wonderful thing for me to do. And the virtue meant I could be trustworthy. And also, I'm always keeping promises. I don't know about you, but how many times you've been let down? Someone promises to do something for you, or they promise to come at a certain time and they're late. It's awful when you get let down. It just really messes up your day, especially if that's someone who's your partner in life or your best friend. Because, you know, of the great virtue of having been a Buddhist monk, especially a Buddhist monk, and hopefully you guys as well, you're much more virtuous than other people, you're much more trustworthy. And I remember a friend, an old school friend, coming to visit my monastery in Thailand. I'd only been a monk for about 3 or 4 years. He came to check out what I was up to. And I told him one of the most beautiful times of the monastic day is in the early morning when we go on alms round in the village. It was so peaceful, a very cool time of the morning, and it was a wonderful cultural ceremony to see. See all those villagers putting a little bit of rice in the monk's bowl. But when I told him this is something not to be missed on your visit, he said, "Yes, but how can I get up at 6 o'clock in the morning? You know, I'm a young man. Young men just aren't genetically programmed to get up that time." But I said, "Never mind, I'll just knock on your door just before 6. Which I did, and he got up and he came on the armchair with me. And on the way back he said, "That was such an amazing experience last night. You told me you'd be there just before 6 to knock on my door. And the amazing part of that was I knew you would be there." He said, "Living in London, people promise me all sorts of things and they never deliver. Or at least I doubt whether they'll be there. But with you, you're a monk, I knew you're going to be there." And he said, "That was so rare that there was someone I could absolutely trust." And that emphasized to me just how important it is to have trust between people. Your friends, can you really trust them all? They say they're going to do something, do they? So often they let you down. But with a person who keeps my precepts, who is a really good Buddhist, who practices virtue, they will never let you down. What a wonderful thing that is in life, to have somebody you can trust. Virtue. So much so that on one conference I was giving some years ago, we had a Buddhist who was an advisor to the Bank of England, a top economist in London. And he was supposed to give some sort of a talk on something or other, but the last minute he changed the subject of his talk to the economic benefits of monks and nuns. And this guy knew what he was talking about. He's a top economist. He was a professor at the university. And, now what benefit are monks and nuns to society? He said, the most powerful benefit monks and nuns or any virtuous people are, is they encourage trustworthiness in others. If any of you do business or any do any transactions, they have something in economics called transaction costs. What they are is the amount of money you have to allow for when your clients don't pay the bill on time. You know, they say 7 days or 14 days, they say the check's in the mail. It hasn't been even posted yet, that's always a lie. I remember ordering a concrete truck from the yard to do some building in Perth. It was late, I called them up, and they said, "Oh yeah, we're so late, the truck has just left the yard." Fine, be here in half an hour. Half an hour later, I hadn't arrived. I gave them a call. I got another man working in the company. So he said, "Oh yeah, yeah, the truck has just left the yard." "That's what your friend said half an hour ago. Oh God, I'll be busted," said the guy. That's what they always say. How many times in business do people lie to you? Which means you don't know what you're doing. I was wasting time waiting over an hour. That's called a transaction cost, when you can't trust people to pay you on time or goods to be delivered on time. They say it's going to be there tomorrow, it's next week before it comes. Or they say that this computer does this, that and the other, and it doesn't. You know, because you can't trust people. That's why it's a huge drain on people's economy. So even like trustworthiness, which is encouraged, virtue, will make the Australian economy and other economies much stronger. So you don't have to pay so much taxes, you can be much wealthier, for goodness sake. Little things like that. Practical examples of virtue, where you can trust people, you can leave bags, and you drop something and people give it back to you, rather than stealing it. Now when we can encourage virtue like that, the life becomes much easier. And it becomes much more beautiful when we can trust one another. So in my life, having lived with a virtuous group of people for such a long time, people you can really trust, and they will look after you, and you will look after them. What they say they will do, they will do. Because of that, I worship virtue. So every time I bow down to a Buddha statue, I'm remembering the importance of virtue in my life. I put my head down, which means I'm raising virtue up This is just a very, very common way of paying respect to things. Even in the old days, you'd curtsy to someone, or in the army, you'd salute, or you'd just a little bow to somebody. It's just saying, I lower my head, this is really more important, so I'm respecting it. And because you respect it that way, it's basic psychology. Because I'm remembering the importance of virtue and I'm worshipping it, it gets stronger in me. It's just a practical way of becoming more virtuous because you remember it every time you do a bow. And the second thing I bow to is peace. Peace in the world, peace in the family, peace in your own heart. Now this is not superstitious stuff, this is stuff which is tangible, which you can touch. Do you live in a family where everyone argues with each other? Is that a very nice place to live? Instead of valuing sort of arguments, instead we can start valuing peace instead. And where do arguments come from in a family? I know this is an old story, but it's one of the best stories, which I tell every time I do a marriage ceremony for people. You know the old story of the chicken and the duck? The two people, they'd just been married, they were having a walk in the park in the afternoon, and then they heard the sound, quack, 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 and she said, oh, listen to that, that's a chicken. I said, what? I said, that's a chicken. No, it's a duck. No, it's a chicken. No, it's a duck. No, it's a chicken. It is a duck. No, it's a chicken. And she started to cry. Have you seen arguments like that in your family today? So the wise person, in this case the guy, he looked at his wife in the eye. He remembered why he married her, squeezed her hand gently, and said, I apologize, I think you're right. That is a chicken. They went quack quack again. Yes, a chicken. Which meant they'd had no more arguments and he got a nice hot dinner day. Now look, the moral of that story is, what's more important, being right or being in harmony? Come on, you people who have arguments. You argue because you think you're right, and you forget the higher priority should be peace, should be harmony. So don't worry who's right. Harmony, peace, is far more important. And number two, you always think that you are right. That could be a chicken from Fukushima nuclear plant, who, because of radiation, now goes quack, quack. And that happens so often, we often get it wrong. And to show how you can get it wrong, I told this story years ago as a great example of how you can add one and one together and get three. How easy it is to misunderstand things. And that was a time some years ago when, because I was trained in Thailand, there was a lot of monks who were being busted for having mistresses. And it's totally against our rules, shouldn't happen. If you do fall in love, disrobe and get married. Don't sort of try and do that as a monk. But I decided one evening in Perth to make a confession, to be honest. And so, quite seriously, you know I can't lie, it's against my rules. And I'm always honest. So I told people, I confessed, that I spent some of the happiest moments in my life in the loving arms of another man's wife. We kissed. I loved her to bits. She was another man's wife. That lady was my mother. You haven't heard that before, you see. A young one kissing, loving to bits, another man's wife. And you think, that's adultery, that's wrong, you're a monk, you shouldn't do that. And of course, that was when I was young, before I was a monk. And that was my mum. My mother was another man's wife. I loved her to bits and I kissed her. Nothing wrong with that, okay? But you can see how it's so easy to misunderstand. So that's why it's a waste of time arguing who's right, who's wrong. This harmony is more important. Give the other person the benefit of the doubt. And then you don't have so many arguments. Give your wife the benefit of the doubt. Give your husband the benefit of the doubt. And then you can have some peace in your life. If that doesn't work, one thing which I'm encouraging every couple, I get them to promise this when I do their marriage for them. I get them to promise that once every year, usually on their anniversary, to do a Buddhist forgiveness ceremony. We're really strong on forgiveness in Buddhism. We don't do punishment or guilt. That's totally not part of our religion at all. Some of you bring that into the Buddhist religion, but in the original Buddhism, the way we practice, we don't have punishment, we don't have guilt. Instead, we acknowledge our mistakes, we forgive them, and we learn. That's all, no punishment. Forgiving means amnesty, and then we learn. And on that point, if there is punishment or guilt, all it ever serves to do is to hide the truth. When you're scared of being punished, you will never confess what actually happened. Which is why, you know, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa by Desmond Tutu started a wonderful trend to settle problems internationally, to bring peace between communities who were fighting for a long time. There was no punishment demanded. As long as a person acknowledged what they've done and they were honest, they were given amnesty, forgiveness, so everyone could learn what went wrong and fix those problems in the future. That works in international problems, but it also works in marriages as well. Do you always tell the truth to the person you love? Of course you don't. Why? Because you're scared. What would he say if he found out how much you spent on your credit card? And why are people scared of the people they commit to and love? It is because they're scared of being scolded or punished, and that hides the truth. You don't want to tell the truth. Why do your children lie to you? Because Dad would kill me if he found out. I've been suspended from school. So you hide it. That is so sad. Because you are suppressing the truth, driving it underground through the fear of punishment or scolding. What a wonderful thing it would be if every parent could tell their child, as long as you tell me the truth, son, daughter, as long as it's truthful, I will never scold you or hurt you at all. Because it's amnesty. Because where you made a big mistake, your parents are not here to scold you or punish you, but to help you. And I first realized that when one of these, I've been in Perth for 30 years now, so many of these little kids have grown up with me. When one of these children, who I'd known before she was born, and I'd seen her being born and then just looking after her, coming to the temples so often, when she was about 17, she came up to me and said, "Ajahn, I'm pregnant." I said, have you told your mum yet, or your dad? "No, they'll kill me if they find out. Ajahn Brahm, could you please tell them for me?" I could sort of sort it out and cool down their parents. So I had to tell their parents, "Your daughter's got pregnant, give her a break, it does happen. You know, people make mistakes, you know, just they're human, okay, please forgive her." But what really shocked me, she was scared to tell her parents, and she really did need her parents' help. How many of you haven't got an Ajahn Brahm or Bhakti Jain you trust to tell your parents for you? And you're all by yourself, scared, not knowing what to do, in a very difficult situation. So please, those who've got children, or those who will have children in the future, they'll get into difficulty from time to time, and that's the time they need their parents most of all. They need it desperately, and they're scared to tell you. Why? Because they're scared of being punished. They've been punished and scolded too often. That is not the way to help people. Peace is the way to help people. Forgiveness, and then you can help your kid. and make sure that they don't make the same mistake again. They learn from mistakes rather than hiding mistakes. So that degree of honesty is just a wonderful thing to find in our society. With married people, you're going to make mistakes. You don't tell each other. So what to do? Every year on your anniversary, I ask the married couple to get a present for each other, just a token present, nothing expensive. And one of them offers a little token present to their partner and says to their partner, "Darling, whatever I have done in the past year, by body, by speech, by mind, which has hurt you or irritated you, or made life difficult for you, intentional or unintentional, just by accident, or things which I didn't do, which I should have done, I apologize, I'm sorry, I really am. Please forgive me." And you have to say it and mean it. Because you've all done something wrong or forgot to do things. And if you don't ask for forgiveness, it stays inside you year after year, like a cancer which destroys your relationship and your trust to one another. It stops the peace of a family. But if every year, once a year, you ask forgiveness, and once you've asked forgiveness, your partner asks forgiveness back. "Darling, me too. I'm sure I've done many things, by body, by speech, by mind, which has irritated you or hurt you. Sometimes intentional, sometimes by accident, or things I didn't do which I was supposed to have done. Please forgive me too." Sincerely. Number one is acknowledging you're imperfect. And number two is knowing that love and peace is more important than being wrong. So you ask forgiveness. Forgiveness is given. Then you maybe go out to dinner or whatever together. Reaffirming your commitment for a peaceful couple. Instead of always having these old memories from years ago, what your husband did, what your wife did, ruining your happy marriage or your relationship. Forgiveness is so important. That's part of creating peace in our world. Peace in communities like in South Africa. But most importantly, peace in our own hearts. You have done wrong things in the past, so please forgive them. Acknowledge them, forgive and learn from them. Don't just keep carrying around the pain of your past, what you've done, and what other people have done to you for such a long time. I talked about that last night, about anger and guilt. Please do forgive yourself. For example, there's some women here, I'm sure, who've had abortions. And sometimes, I'm not sure why it is in our society, we're so cruel to women who've had abortions. Most difficult decision in their life. That's hard enough to decide to terminate a being which is growing inside of you. And on top of that, you add this terrible guilt. You're an evil girl, you're going to go to hell, or even worse. That is just so cruel and unacceptable in today's world. If a woman does make that decision, which will always be the hardest decision in your life, those here who had one know that. They don't need any blame or any feelings of guilt. They need as much compassion, kindness and understanding as you can possibly give them. That's all. So, if those ones who have had that, they still need, they need to do some sort of forgiveness ceremony. So if you're a Christian, a Buddhist, I don't care who you are, go to the nearest place you can feel inspiration, bow three times, and just ask forgiveness. Whether it's a Jesus Christ or whether it's a Buddha statue, any sort of inspiring example of wisdom and compassion, of course they will forgive you. Every time and all times. So get that forgiveness and just wipe that slate clean. Go on with your life. No one wants you to be suffering and carry that pain from the past. So this is actually learning how to find peace in your life. To let go of those painful memories which have caused all the problems for you, which stops you being successful and happy and living a good life. So I worship peace so much that it's so easy for me to bow down to a Buddha statue and I'm remembering the importance of peace. Forgiveness, letting go. So every time I bow down, I'm reinforcing my commitment to peace in this world. Even creating peace between the different religions of this world, let alone within Buddhism. And that is why I always recall going to a big Christian school, now in Perth. It was Christ Church Grammar School. Because I knew the chaplain there, Frank Sheehan, and you know, we'd done many things together. He said, why don't you come to my school to actually to teach the morning assembly? I said, yeah, sure, I'm up for anything. For a cup of tea and breakfast, certainly if you can free. And so I turned up there just as school began and had to wait outside while all the school kids gathered inside in their hall. And I was outside with the chaplain and with the principal. And the principal turned round to me and said, you know, we're Christians in this school, not Buddhists, we're Christians. And in the main hall there's an image of Jesus Christ. And he said, we're going to bow down to this image. It's a small bow as we go in. You're a Buddhist, you don't need to bow. And at that I took my opportunity. I looked at him and said, principal, I demand my right to bow to your statue of Jesus. And because he got shot, I said, what do you mean you're a Buddhist? You can't bow to him. Why not? I said, I can see something in that image to inspire me. Some kindness, some turning the other cheek, some simplicity. The original Jesus was a very simple person. I can bow down to that. And he got very impressed that you can, when you bow down to something, you're seeing something in that image, whatever you can see, which you can respect and worship. That's what you're focusing on. And because you're worshipping it, it's being increased in your own heart. And also you're creating this amazing sort of bridges between these great traditions. So the next time his school kids came to visit Bodhidharma Monastery, the principal came as well. So I took him into my cave and all over, and he bowed to the Buddha statue. Isn't that nice? Because he understood what you're bowing for. You know, it's not worshipping and becoming a Buddhist. It's actually worshipping what it represents. And the last time I bowed, the third time, worshipping compassion. Compassion is one of the most beautiful things you'll ever see in this world. When someone does a tiny act which makes you cry. I read this story a long time ago. There was an oncologist, a specialist in a hospital in the United States. And his friends, his colleagues, referred a very, very difficult case to him. This was this old woman who had a severe cancer. I don't know what type of cancer, I'm not a doctor. And everybody else had basically given up on her. She was just no hope. But they referred it to him anyway. And he looked at the case, did a bit of research, and he decided to give it everything he got. He called in a lot of favours for his friends in the other parts of the United States. Flew them in. Did all sorts of interventions, some no state of the art, sometimes, you know, just the most modern possibilities of treating this cancer. He really gave it extra, I mean a lot extra than he'd give anybody else. And it actually worked. She got into remission. She was going to live. And she was so happy that she was going to live, but so scared at the medical bill she was going to get. Because you know that medical care in the United States is not like in Australia, it's not for free. You know, the more care, the more operations, the more procedures, the more you have to pay. So it's looking at many hundreds of thousands of dollars. Rewind to 30 years earlier. 30 years earlier, that oncologist, that specialist, was a medical student, paying his way through med school, as many people did. Even when I was a student, I used to get jobs and vacations to help pay my bills. So there he was, getting a job as a door-to-door salesman. You know, the worst job in the world as a student. Knocking on doors, selling rubbish to people. And apparently he knocked on one person's door. He'd been selling things all day. Late in the afternoon, you know, a young woman answered the door, what do you want? I'm selling this, do you want some? No, go away. But this woman stopped and said, when was the last time you had anything to eat today? He said, not since this morning, since breakfast, I've been going all day. Just wait a minute, young man. And she went into her kitchen and got out a glass of milk and two cookies for this young man. That's all. He never forgot that. So when this lady got her medical bill, she opened it in trepidation, and what she saw was not hundreds of thousands of dollars, but a little scrawled note from the doctor himself, paid 30 years ago with one glass of milk and two cookies. It was the same girl. He never forgot that simple act of kindness of a woman, a young woman, who was just concerned that he hadn't eaten that day and hadn't had anything to drink on a hot day. And had just given him a glass of milk and two biscuits. That's why he took that case. Now he read the lady's name, it rang a bell. He checked out the address, it was the same address he remembered 30 years ago. Which is why he knew it was that girl who'd helped him, who'd been kind to him. So he gave it anything he possibly could to heal her. And once she was healed, he paid the bill himself. What a beautiful story of compassion that is. A true story. For why little acts of kindness save you hundreds of thousands of dollars eventually in your life. Those are beautiful stories. So every time I come across the story of kindness and compassion, it makes me cry sometimes. I just get so teary when I say stories like that. They're real. And they bring beauty to our life. Sometimes we get so negative about how people treat one another in this world. And every now and again you come across a story of kindness and compassion, and it just makes you cry. And you never lose because of that. No one loses. It makes the world a beautiful place to live in. I want to live in a beautiful place, and I'm going to create that place, and I hope you will help me create that place. Any opportunity there is to do an act of kindness and compassion, don't think of how much it's going to cost, just do it. You will never, ever regret an act of kindness. So, my third time I bow down to compassion, to kindness. Just helping someone you don't know for no reason, but just the opportunity to be kind. I'm sure you've had many examples of that as well. But because I remember that every time I bow down, I remember it, I worship it, it means my compassion becomes stronger and stronger and stronger. And it's only because I practice compassion that way that I keep coming to Melbourne every year, year after year after year after year. And it's not the first time, this is about the third time this year I come to. And you're going to get me to come back in November as well.
And July.
Yeah, and July as well. Cheapest. I'm just too compassionate. No, of course not. And you know sometimes that when you're compassionate, you think it's going to cost you something. It never does cost you something. You always get things back in return. This is why, another story I remember, you know this in monastic life, these robes we wear. You know, actually, the robe I wear over here, I can tell you the story, well, this robe came from Hong Kong. I was in Hong Kong last February. Usually, you know, the robe you wear, like this one over here, it's got all patches in it. Please don't say, I need a new robe. This is an example of frugality. Why is it you've got a patch or a tear in your jacket or in your trousers and you go and patch it? Or you tell either brother, you throw it away, get a new one. Haven't you seen latest fashions? I've seen all these girls these days, they've got tears and holes in their robes. This is fashionable. That fashion came from monks. Just like these came from monks, but as Bruce Willis or other people got bored, we started that. But, so it's wonderful. I'm simple, okay? Why do you need to waste money on a new jacket? It still keeps me warm. Just because it's got holes in it, to me it's just cool, awesome, it's fashionable. So leave me, don't get a new one. But this particular robe, I had an old robe with some patches in. You know what happened in Hong Kong? They took it from me, they said they're going to auction it to raise money for my next sponsor. And then it's got holes in it. Therefore, of course, it's holy robe. So this is a new one. Usually they've got patches all over the place. So we really do try to keep things nice and simple. But you know, every now and again, You know, sometimes people are crunchy, but these ropes in the old days, we had to actually to make them ourselves. And to make them ourselves, we had to, you know, use white cloth, cut it up, sew it. And with men, we hadn't sewn before, but you know, it's just a little bit of training to sew a rope. And then you had to get the dye, which was from a jackfruit tree, you know, to chop it up. And then you had to get water from the well, you've got to boil the water, put the jackfruit chips in it to get the sap out, to concentrate the sap, and then you dye the robes. It took, you know, a couple of days to do this, and there was 3 monks who were being ordained soon. They had to make their own set of robes. That was our rule, just to make sure that you really wanted to become a monk. So we're making our set of, well, these monks were making their set of 3 robes. They've been up for about 2 nights without any sleep, about 48, 60 hours with no sleep at all. If you've ever done that, you notice maybe young people do that because they go out nightclubbing and stuff like that, but it really hurts. You know, sleeplessness is what they use sometimes to torture people, sleep deprivation. And I knew these poor monks were having a very hard time. So in the evening, after the evening meeting and meditation, I went to see them. It was about 10 o'clock at night. And I said, I'm going to break the rules out of compassion, out of kindness. I will look after the dive pot tonight. You go and rest. And I was breaking the rules. Do you mind? They didn't argue. They were off like a flash. Yeah, just to get a rest for a few hours. And then 3 o'clock, the bell went for the morning meeting, so 3:05, they were out. Thank you so much, Ajahn Brahm. You gave us the rest. Just a few hours, that's all you really need, is to take the harsh pain off the tiredness. But I couldn't go to sleep, I had to go to the morning meeting. So I went to the morning meeting, and many of you meditate. You know that sometimes you're very tired and sleepy, especially if you haven't had a good night's sleep. That morning, I was perfectly alert, had loads of energy. And I couldn't figure out why. I'd been working all night, hadn't slept, why have I got so much energy? And I asked the monk who was with me at the time, this is weird, please I apologize, I broke the rule last night. I know they're supposed to help themselves, but I help them out so they get sleep. And the monk was wise enough, I said, look, that's good, that's compassion. You know, what are the rules for anyway, if we can't be kind? In monastery in Perth where I live, you know, I wrote the rules for the monastery. You have the monastic rules done by the Buddha, we always add rules on. And you can see those set of rules. Rule number one, compassion. That's the main rule in running down a monastery. Hopefully that will be the main rule in whatever monastery you build here. It trumps all other rules. And he said the reason why you've got so much energy today is because you were kind. You did an act of sacrifice and kindness for others. You weren't thinking of yourself. That is where your energy came from. And I took that on board, and I practiced that for most of my monastic life since. You are kind to others. You're compassionate. Forget about what you need. Go and help somebody else. And you never, ever lose. You get more energy, not less. And so we've done that so often, that's why I can travel all around the world and still get enough energy to teach all day, simply because you run on compassion energy. Not fusion energy, not fission energy, not coal seam gas, but compassion energy. It's amazing how powerful it is. That's why it's so easy to worship kindness. And of course, by worshipping it, you're remembering its importance. Sometimes we forget. We all know the importance of things like virtue, peace, and compassion. Sometimes we forget. That's why the bhava really helps. So we take an old tradition like that. We explain it, what you're doing it for. And you get all these people come to my temple. You know, the Australians, even the Christians, even the Muslims start bowing. Why? Because we're not bound to some god. We can't do that in our religion. But bound to virtue, peace and compassion, I can do that. And they understand why we do it, which is so important that we please take all the superstitions away from Buddhism. Explain what we do and why we do it. And then you find it becomes much more understandable. Not just understandable, it becomes respected by everybody, including our children and our friends who aren't Buddhist at all. And also, it helps us become better people. Which is the meaning of our lives. We are here not to just to enjoy, but to be better people, to the end of our lives, to look back and say, what have we done? How have we made this world a better place? Because that's what happens at the end of life. It's just like at the end of the financial year. You tally up, you know, this sort of the debit and the credit column and see just whether you're in sort of surplus or not. Unfortunately, the federal government is never in surplus, but I hope you guys are. More in your money, but in your spiritual quality. It's always making more. And what a wonderful thing that is. Now, when I was looking for the meaning of life as a student, I was a young man, 18 or 19, 20, you know, you had a great university degree, the whole of your life is in front of you, what am I going to do for my life? I realized that what I should do, find a career, find a job, find a path which fulfilled two main objectives. And that had to be personal happiness and fulfillment. That's really important for each one of you to have a good time, to enjoy your life. Now, we're not into suffering in Buddhism, we try to escape from suffering. Enjoy your life, have fun, have a good time. But I couldn't just do that for myself. You had to serve others, to make sure you were making a difference, to lessen other people's suffering, to make, you know, people, you know, to bring love to others, kindness, relieve suffering. So I had to find something to fulfill those two objectives. Each one of you do that in your own way. To me, it was a Buddhist monk. And as a Buddhist monk, I remember going to a retreat a long time ago with another monk. And I was getting bored, the interviews, I had to be the attendant, the interviews during the retreat, hearing the same old stuff, I'm falling asleep in my meditation, I'm having an argument with my wife, my kids aren't sort of doing the right thing, blah, 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 hear this, going to sleep, until this one woman came in and she said, I want to thank you for saving my life. And the way she said it, I woke up. What had this monk done? So this woman thanked him for saving her life. And this was a story. This was in the 60s and 70s. This was a student at a university in the UK. And she had a depression. That's so common for people to get depressed, you know, in the student years. It's so tough. You've got to get good grades. You've got your social life to deal with as well. Finding a boyfriend, a girlfriend. It's so difficult and so troublesome and so easy for people to get depressed. And of course, in those days, the doctors just gave her Valium, just gave her drug. And she got addicted. Mm-hmm. And she'd been on that drug for 5 or 6, 7 years. And at this retreat, you know, you're supposed to keep precepts, you know, like not taking alcohol or drugs. That was actually mean non-medicinal drugs, the heroin, the marijuana, that sort of stuff. But she misunderstood. She thought, oh my goodness, I'm not allowed to take my Valium. So she didn't. For 9 days. Because it was so peaceful, everyone was meditating, everyone was so kind, she could do that. But after the retreat finished, she had to move through Glasgow Station to get home. Now, this was any sort of big station or in the centre of Melbourne or wherever you are, that's really stressful. So many people rushing around. And she said she almost lost it, she almost jumped on the tracks because the withdrawal symptoms from Valium were just so hard to bear. She only just held herself together to get on the train, get home. And she said she spent the next 2 months just sitting in a chair. Couldn't do anything. As the effects of that Valium managed to work its way out of her system. But it did. And the result was, she said she was alive again. She could actually feel the sun on her cheeks. She could notice the wind. You know, before she was in a cloud. She was in a mist. She couldn't live. She couldn't feel. She couldn't hear anything. Everything was muted. Now it was alive, bright, vibrant. She said, thank you for giving my life back. When I heard that, I was so impressed. I made my vow. Said, my whole meaning of my life will be fulfilled if one person comes up to me and said, Ajahn Brahm, because of your help, your teachings, or whatever, you saved my life. When the first person said that, he almost cried. You've done something, you've helped someone. And I'm not exaggerating now, over 1,000 people have said that to me now. The books, the tapes, you've got all these letters in a cupboard in my room. Four people without you haven't committed suicide. If you read the forward to Opening the Door of Your Heart, or the second edition, there you'll see the story of one amongst thousands of a woman from Switzerland, from Bern, who had don't know how many cancers in her body, depression, anxiety disorder, the whole works. She was a mess. And her doctors had given up on her, she was going to die. Psychologists, psychiatrists couldn't help her at all. Some friend gave her a copy of Open the Door of Your Heart. Within a couple of months, full remission, no more anxiety disorder or depression. Psychologists said, you're free, you're healthy again. So the first thing she did when she heard that from the doctor was to purchase a ticket to Australia, to Perth, for one and only reason, to see me. And I can always recall her coming into the dining hall of Odigana Monastery, asking, who's that young girl? I said, I am, and bursting into tears. And she gave me her little book. Her little book was so dog-eared, she'd read it hundreds of times, but she said, can you please sign for me? That was one book I love signing. I wouldn't have missed that for the world. She came all that way from Switzerland for that one thing, nothing else. Not shopping, not touring about. Just to say thank you. That gave me the meaning of life. And I challenge every one of you to have an experience like that. To have somebody. It may be your partner, the one you commit to in life. It may be a son, it might be a friend, it may be a sister or whatever. You help them big time. You give them maybe a small thing, just like a glass of milk or two cookies. What's more to you means a world to someone else. And when they come and say, paid 30 years ago with a glass of milk and two cookies, they say, without you, I'd be dead. I'd have committed suicide. Thank you so much. And they mean it. Then you have found the meaning of life. You can't really put that into words better than what I've said so far. But that is what compassion is. And that's why it's just so easy to worship it. And is this Buddhist? Is this Christian? Is this Islam? Is it atheist? I don't care how you package it. But you can feel it. You know what you're talking about. I like Buddhism because, you know, we don't have anything to any axe to bear with any other religions. You know, you go to Muslim temple, mosque or whatever. You know, one of the things I was very proud of. You know, it's nice to be proud of good things. But well, I was so friendly to people of other religions that over in the Anglican Cathedral in Perth, I mean, George Pell's city would go ballistic if he knew this. But in the Anglican Cathedral, not George Pell, it's Jensen, Archbishop Jensen, he's the Anglican guy. In the Dean of St. George's Cathedral in Perth, you know, the main, he became such a good friend of mine that he said, why don't you come and give the sermon at the Sunday Eucharist? Which is the main service, you know, in the Anglican Church, in the cathedral. I said, what a great idea. Channel 7 interviewed me for that, it was on the TV. That was the first time I went on TV and had to have makeup. It was really embarrassing. And that second Mark Ajahn Prabhali, he was watching me. And that was being made up by this girl and just stuff. He was laughing at me, he was ridiculing me. He didn't make it easy for me. I said, come on, buddy. You'd be worse if you saw me. I'd never live out now. But anyway, so he gave the Eucharist. He gave the sermon. And the Dean, you know, John Shepherd, you know, he told me, and he knows what he's talking about, as did the Archbishop. It's a new one now. He said that this is the first time in 2,000 years of Christianity we've had a non-Christian, let alone a Buddhist, give the sermon at the Eucharist. And what happened at that service that we had half the people from my temple came, and half were Christians. The lovely thing is, no one knew who was who. It wasn't about the Buddhists on one side, the Christians on the other side. There was no space. Everyone was crowded into this cathedral. And of course, you always, just to make things interesting, had a couple of crazy Christians outside saying, "You can't have a Buddhist give a sermon in a Christian. You'll all go to hell. This is evil. Jesus will..." And then what happened is, one of the priests, or two of the priests, they took this guy and they threw him out of the church and locked the doors. I thought that was very symbolic. The Buddhists could come in, but the crazy people had to go out. And I gave this sermon. The people actually that were sitting on the windows, everything was so crashed into that room. And after the sermon, it was such a moving experience with all the Christians and the Buddhists, literally shoulder to shoulder. You're just enjoying a bit of wisdom, compassion, virtue, goodness, peace. And everybody just, Bansadeen came up, I embraced him, put my arm around him, and everybody just gave a really long standing ovation. It wasn't because of the talk, it was because of the gesture, of harmony, of working together. What a beautiful thing that is in our world to do. Why can't we have more of that? We're trying hard to create more peace in our world. Buddhism is well suited to do that. So please, if you know, I'm talking to you Sri Lankans, if you know any of those Sri Lankan monks who are destroying Muslim mosques in Sri Lanka, please take away all your support. That is not acceptable. That is not destroying Muslim mosques, that is destroying Buddhism. If you know any of the Burmese monks trying to have violence against the Rohingyas in Burma or in other Muslim people, tell them you are destroying Buddhism. You're destroying hope in our world. Why? Because you're destroying virtue, peace, and compassion. You're not worshipping the Buddha anymore. The Buddha is not a statue. The Buddha is a symbol. And when you understand what the symbol represents, then you understand what Buddhism is. In Buddhism, we don't worship a statue. We worship virtue, peace, compassion. Very simple answer. So if any of your friends ask you, "What is Buddhism anyway? Tell us in brief. What is Buddhism?" Please don't say Four Noble Truths, depending on his name. It confuses people. It confuses you, not even you know what you're talking about. Just say, "Look, we worship virtue, peace, and compassion." What a beautiful thing that is. You might call it Sila Samadhi Pragya if you wish. It's not really, well, wisdom is compassion. It's so close together. So that's what we do. And that's something which, if you remember that, you will all become better Buddhists. And you'll help people become better Christians, better Muslims, better atheists, better Australians, better anything. Because these are things which people can know, they can touch, they can get hold of. And people are so important in our world. So please take away all your superstitions and all the rituals. Chanting, 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 please. Not so much chanting. Because people chant, chant, chant. They chant the Metta Sutta. May all beings be happy and well. May all beings be happy and well. As soon as they get out of the temple, they argue with their wife. What they say, may all beings be happy and well, but not my wife. Yeah, you kind of see there's a deception there, because it's just on the surface, you're getting to the heart of things. So please get to the heart of things. And then you'll find that you Buddhists here, you really will be sort of making a difference to our society. The Buddhist Society of Victoria, especially, which you all support, will really grow. And the monasteries will grow as well. What's the point of having a monastery if it's got no heart? A temple where there's an argument. Please remember, as I told you the last time I was here, you are the Buddhist Society of Victoria. You're Buddhist first, society afterwards. And Victoria last of all. To hell with all these states and these countries, who belongs where and what. You know, the Sri Lanka, Thailand, you know, Iceland. I don't care where you come from. You're human beings, and so you belong. And I love you all, as you should love all beings. The only time there's a problem with Sri Lanka and Australia is in the cricket, nothing else. That's just a bit of funny games. If you do that, you understand the meaning of Buddhism yourself, and you also understand the meaning of life. And it's so obvious when it's explained to you. You go out there, be virtuous, increase goodness, and there's so much corruption, so much selfishness, so much cruelty. Don't complain about it, do something about it. One of the Chinese sayings, which I always keep in mind, rather light a candle than complain about darkness. So many people are negative, they complain about the government. Why don't you stand? For the Green Party or the Buddhist Party or whatever, I don't care what party you stand for. If you're complaining about the government, why don't you join it and change it? Challenge you. Instead of complaining about the world, do something about it. Be a better person. Instead of complaining, oh, people these days are so selfish, don't complain, do something about it. Be less selfish. Be kind, be generous, whatever it is. Be compassionate. Find an opportunity to be kind. There's always so many opportunities available. Too often we let them pass by. I remember when Atul Sumedha and the monks first went to England. They came to the forest monasteries. There was these beautiful places, lots of space. And they were put in a house in London during the winter time. If you've ever been in London during the winter time, you will know why they have a psychological malady called seasonal affective disorder. SAD is a type of depression. And you only have to be there November, December, January to know why. The sun only comes up maybe 9:30 in the morning. By 2:30 it's down again. It's so dark and grey in London at that time. Always overcast. You don't see the sun. There's only clouds. And even when it rains, it never rains properly. It's this hard, depressing type of rain called drizzle. Even the name makes you depressed. And those would be to England at that time. You know, people wear all these coats and overcoats and scarves. And they've got no colour to them. You never see like an Australian of browns and reds. And actually, you're pretty depressed. You've got no colour in here. Really, you've got beautiful red, blue. Over here is okay. Over there is really depressing. They all wear grey. All the buildings are grey. The floor is grey. The pavement is grey. And what type of tea do the English drink?
Grey.
No grey tea. No wonder they're depressed. So these poor monks were stuck in this little house in Hampstead. Greyness day after day when it just came from the jungles and forests. But I always remember Atul Sumedha saying he was getting really depressed. He was just looking out the window into the drizzle early one morning. Everything was grey, nothing to do. And then he saw one of these English gentlemen on the way to work in the morning. You know, with the whole thing, the bowler hat, you know, just a nice suit, and the umbrella, and the briefcase. Obviously, you know, maybe he's sort of a manager, or at least a high manager, because he was really well groomed on the way to work. And he also saw, you know, in the doorway of one of the houses on the street, there was a homeless man. He was sheltering from the cold and rain in the doorway of a commercial building. And I remember those homeless people from my youth. They would usually drink the cheapest form of alcohol called methylated spirits, just to keep warm at night, and which made them smell disgusting. The health problems were huge with them as well. But that's basically all they had. And he saw this beautiful, well-groomed businessman stopped by the homeless man, just bent over, put his arm around the homeless man, even though he knew that the smell would be on the well-laundered suit. Pick him up and training for breakfast. He said at that point, even though the rain was still falling and the skies were still overcast, that morning London was beautiful. It shone, it glowed. He saw an unexpected act of kindness. Little acts like that are what take away the depression of life. Maybe that businessman didn't know that mum was watching. He didn't know that mum would tell the story to me, and I'd tell the story to hundreds of thousands. A little act of kindness ripples all the way from the winter of London to Melbourne to Monash University. Never think an act of kindness goes unnoticed. It's beautiful. So please, take the opportunity. Does life have meaning? It has when you put meaning into it. Virtue, peace, compassion. Thank you so much for listening. Okay, now any questions or comments you have? I stunned you.
Yeah,
that's what religion is supposed to do, not bore the hell out of you. It's supposed to be meaningful. You get in contact with your heart and then you share it with other people. And you get lots of nice stories and I share them with other people in the comments. If it has touched the heart, it has been a good talk tonight. It's not because, oh, what a beautiful talk that was, but because you become better people afterwards. You've done one more act of kindness today or tomorrow, then the talk is meaningful. One more little bit of virtue. One more bit of more peace in your life. Then we can realise what a beautiful world this is. We don't actually have a question here, not to this one person, there's another one question coming over there. This is totally off subject, but it's an interesting set of questions. Number one, what are the difficulties, problems, challenges faced by a monk or a nun? You know the old story. What fun does a monk have? My father used to write this joke. What fun does a monk have? The answer is none. That's not true, okay. We are still not the uncle. I have a lot of fun. You know, there's always challenges, you know, as a monk or a nun. Whatever job you have in life is a challenge. And of course our challenge is actually to find peace inside ourselves and develop compassion for others. It's not that easy when you first start as a monk, understanding how you work, understanding how your mind works. That's another reason why I became a monk. You know, I was a scientist before. I already told you that in Cambridge I was very privileged. The college system in that place made you socialised with all your lecturers. That's what a college was. They had the lecturers, the professors and the students, and we all met together. It should have been inspiring for the students to have access to the incredibly brilliant minds. And for the lecturers and professors, they had access to the students, and we'd always be actually supplying them with new ideas. That's where they got most of the breakthroughs from, the students with the weird ideas. So it was actually a win-win for both of them. But what it also meant was, and this is actually my experience of being in such a big place, was all those professors, they were Nobel laureates. They were brilliant in their field, but stupid in life. You know, they had divorces from their wives, they were always having arguments, getting drunk. As human beings, they weren't very developed. They were just so focused on one thing, which was their life. And it hasn't changed because a couple of years ago, because I said I was good friends, I'd make lots of friends outside of Buddhism. Because I was really close friends with Professor David Blair, who's a professor of physics at the University of Western Australia, when Sir Roger Penrose came to Australia, any physicist here, anyone in science, knows he's probably the second most famous physicist alive today, Sir Roger Penrose of Oxford University. He is the one who discovered black holes.
Mm-hmm.
It's an incredible, brilliant piece of mathematics which showed that black holes exist. Stephen Hawking actually took his research, turned it backwards, and found out that that's how the universe starts, the Big Bang. So the black holes, gravity sucking everything in, turn it around, from nothing, everything spews out, the Big Bang. So Sir Roger Penrose came through, and because I had my contacts, I had the invitation to have dinner with him. You know, with about 20 or 30 other, mostly scientists, from NASA, other professors, who also I knew really well. So this was a top physicist in the world. We had 20 or 30 people. Of course I didn't have dinner. Can't have dinner. They gave me a cup of tea, that's all. But I wasn't there for the food. I was there to meet a really famous physicist who I was personally in awe of. And of course, there were only 20 or 30 people who had a chance to talk to the guy. And I started chatting with him. And he couldn't carry a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
After a while, he just couldn't engage with him. Mm-hmm. And I tried, other people tried. After an hour, I was sitting next to this girl from NASA, having a great conversation about science and Buddhism. And I looked around, and this professor, you know, famous, knighted, famous guy from Oxford University, Roger Penrose, was actually standing there like a wallflower. No one was talking to him at all. He had no wife, don't have any friends, brilliant in front of the blackboard, but stupid in life. He didn't know how to connect with people. If you think about like crazy professors, that was one of them. And I never wanted to be like that. Now I want, yeah, it's great if you're brilliant, but I wanted to be well adjusted to life. And that was one of the reasons I left that place and became a Buddhist, became a monk. To me, it seemed to be giving you much more meaning. So you're really investigating, especially instead of the outside world, the inside world. You'd already got some of the ideas from quantum physics, where that's the first time in science you say, you know, the mind, the knower, the consciousness interferes with the physical world. That was quantum physics, the observer, collapsing the Schrodinger equation. When there's an observation, then we have reality. It was the first time in science where we realize this world is not just separate from us. This universe depends upon the knowers, us, consciousness, to exist fundamentally. And that fascinated me. And from there, obviously, you started to look into this thing we call the mind. Through meditation. It's hard to do this, but it's the most enormous fun you can ever have to meditate. It's tough work, but when you get the message, you find out how to do it, not only do you answer all those questions of physics and of life and philosophy, you also have incredible bliss at the same time. Now you've all heard about these monks or these hermits getting ecstatic in the caves. You actually do that. You do get ecstasy, which is, you know, almost you can't stand so much pleasure. And it's not that I had a deprived life as a young man. I had my girlfriend, I had sex, I had good sex. But I had better meditation. And there we go. So if that doesn't get you interested in becoming a monk, I don't know what that is. So there are challenges, but there's many rewards as well. And of course, you know, those challenges are also just finding, especially as you become a senior monk or a senior nun, you get so much management and administration and counselling, looking after other people. But you know that the strange thing I found out, and this is good news for you and also for you, Fennel Jagannatha, I had many friends now, who spent most of their time in the caves, in the forest, never helping many people at all. And I was always into some service. Yeah, I'd meditate very deeply, but I'd also volunteer, you know, to help with people's robes, doing visas and many other stuff. And I found out after many years, when we talked together about our development, that my meditation was far deeper and all those monks who have time by themselves. At first I couldn't understand that. I thought, you had all that time to be a hermit, to meditate by yourself with no responsibilities, and I had to sort of balance my meditation with my service. Now I understand that your service, your giving, your letting go is part of your success in meditation. If you can serve the community as a head nun and really give to others, when you stop and you meditate, your meditation will take off. But if you just think about yourself, by meditation, you'll become dry and you'll never get anywhere. This is what happens in life. I know that sometimes people, what's the difference between Mahayana and Theravada? Is Theravada really selfish? You know, just think about our own meditation. It's not. We serve a lot. We really give out to other people. You know, we're kind as well. Compassion is part of our path. But if you could balance that compassion to others and that peace inside your own heart, then it's really powerful. That is actually how you develop the deepest of meditation from this out. Not by just ignoring others and becoming a hermit. Not by just working all day and every day. But having that balance, that is where you get the power to get deep meditation. So it's finding that balance. And clearly to know is the balance is not just being by yourself retreat year after year. That makes you very dry. What are the downsides of life as a monk or a nun? None. I can't see any. If there were, I'd leave. You know the thing about being a monk or a nun in our tradition? We can leave at any time. I've been a monk now for 39 years. I can leave this evening. What I've got to do is turn around to a monk and say, I'm leaving, I'm not a monk anymore. Oops! No, you've got to mean it. You've got to protect it. It's that easy. You don't have any ceremony. And that is a wonderful thing about the way the Buddha established the monks and nuns. Because if you're a Catholic priest, once you ordain, you can't get out. It literally is a one-way street. Yeah, they can defrock you, but you're still a priest. Because you can't practice anymore. And that's a terrible thing. It's one of the reasons, I think, why there's problems in the Catholic Church. Because some young men, they ordained with the best intentions when they're very young. And you change. You know, you find out that's not really what I wanted to do. But it's too late now. It's a one-way street. And so you have people who don't want to be there, who have to be there. And that is cruel. But, for monastics, if you don't want to be there, it's best you're out. I'd rather have a happy layperson than an unhappy monk or an unhappy nun. That's obvious. There's compassion, there's common sense. So that's why we have this opportunity. Any of you think you want to try it, you can try it, but it doesn't work out, you can leave. You know a weird thing which happens in Perth. We've had many monks in this road. You know, they're all married now in very good relationships. And you ask the women, and they know disrobed monks make excellent husbands. They do. No, the wives come and say, thank you for training. She's so sensitive, he's so kind, he's so dependable, so trustworthy, he's so soft and easy to deal with. I say, yeah, I trained him that way. That was yours. So, I'm sure that's the same with disrobed nuns, they probably make wonderful wives. It's true, so you really. If you find us a monk who's disrobed, we're happy first. These are very, very high quality men to know. It's true. There's a lot of these people I've ordained as monks, and they're always together. You ask the wives, and how's it going? He said, he's so wonderful guy. And that's after years and years and years. I said, yeah, that's because of me. He said, yeah, thank you. Can a monk not disrobe and return to the world of love? Of course they can. And the nice thing about it is there's no sense of having failed. You know, there's no sense of you hopeless person, you know, you disrobe, you know, you've been a stain on the character of the Sangha that you've left. No, they've given it a good try. And we don't have this negativity and say, oh, you stupid nun, you know, you just rode, what do you do that for? And say, well done, you've lasted 1 or 2, 3 years. What a wonderful thing that is. You've done that. It's so hard to do. Well done. Always positive, always praise. You never sort of criticize at all. So when people do this rode, you praise them. Well done. You know, you've lasted so long. Excellent. And how to observe practice state precepts at home? Does one need to make a vow? See if a mattress place in the bed. Okay. The 8 precepts, that's one of the rules people use. But please don't keep 8 precepts every day, because it's very difficult. If you want to keep 8 precepts, go to the monastery, join the monastery. 5 precepts is good enough. 8 precepts once a week or once a month if you want. And you can sleep on a mattress. Just make sure it's not a luxurious bed. That's one of the precepts. So it's not that hard to do that, as long as you understand what they are and you don't take it to extremes. We're not into torturing ourselves as Buddhists. That's one of the other things I like about being a Buddhist monk. We don't whip ourselves, you know, when we make mistakes. You know, like flagellation they have in some of these weird cults. Nothing like that at all. It's so kind and so soft and so such a beautiful lifestyle. So can you go swimming? Of course you can go swimming. Especially if you're out here. And can you go shopping for daily needs? Of course you can go shopping. You know, some of the women would get sort of depressed and anxiety disorders when you go shopping. Okay, someone makes an announcement. How can you go? Okay. They want 10 minutes to make an announcement before the talk, so I can understand. But there's another 15 minutes to go yet before we stop. It's only 9:30 now. So, thank you for those questions. Anyone else got any questions about what we're talking about tonight or something connected? Yeah? Okay, you've got a note there. I've got another one over here. Okay, to step up, build a monastery, forest monastery, involves clearing the land. Does that cause killings of beings about how to observe the first precept? No, just don't cut down trees willy-nilly. So you try and work around nature. If ever you go to the monastery we have in Perth, you know, we try to sort of build everything around nature, so it actually fits in there. Now one example of that, because I was the builder in the first days of our monastery in Perth, and I built this A-frame hut in front of this termite mound. No, sorry, not termite, ant mound. So it's this big ant hill, and there was a clear place in front of it, and it was a good place to build a hut, so I built one there. But I really had a lot of mindfulness and kindness for those ants. You know, you put down logs of wood, you made sure you never put it on the ant mound. You're driving sort of a tractor past it, you always make a long detour around it. It was difficult, troublesome to keep avoiding the ant mound. But you are a monk, you're compassionate. Even though it was troublesome, took extra time, I made sure I protected that ant mound. And once that hut was finished and I moved into it, those ants never ever came into that hut. Other huts they come into, that one they left alone. Don't ever underestimate animals' intelligence, even ants. If you look after them, it's weird and strange, but I've seen that too many times, they look after you. Other huts they came into, that one they never did. Because I took a lot of effort looking after them. Later on, a stupid Anagarika drove a tractor over it. And they said, what do you do that for? And then they started coming in. Can you see just people's stupidity sometimes? It took hours and hours of extra work to avoid that. Because someone was heedless, in a rush, no compassion. Just months of hard work were destroyed by me. And those poor ants. So look after nature. Well, that's how we conserve things, and it's amazing how nature looks after you. So if you have to cut down a tree, apologize to it first. And I do that. He took the tree, look, I'm terribly sorry to need to have to come down. I'm sorry, but you know, you have to build a road or the council tells us to. apologize first of all. People might think you're stupid. Now, what does a tree know? What does a tree hear? But you know, this is a true story from the early days. A woman came and said, she was a Malaysian woman, married to an Australian guy with two little kids. And they had a big tree in the back of their house, so her Australian husband wanted to cut it down. And she had a dream the night before, telling her very powerfully, don't cut that tree down. She dreamt of it. This is a true story. I was there at the time. And she told her husband in the morning, I had this dream. Don't cut the tree down. Now this Australian guy said, right, I'm doing it today. And he got a chainsaw out, cut the tree down. And basically, to show his wife, who was boss, he got his two young children to urinate on the tree stump. And the reason why she came and saw us is because a few weeks after that, her husband was diagnosed with cancer, and both children had urinary infections. And she said, you know, just a coincidence, it's just too strong. I dreamt of that tree, and my husband cut it down, and afterwards he's been diagnosed with a cancer, and my two children, he told them to pee on it. And now what's happened to them? They've got urinary infections. And they asked the mum what to do. That was Ajahn Chakra. And he asked me at the time, he said, and he asked me, and we decided to go and ask forgiveness of the tree when your husband's at work, because he will never do it. With your two children, say sorry. She did, urinary infections healed up. As for the cancer, she never came back again, so I'm not sure what happened. It's just too coincidental to be sort of just dismissed. So please, if you have to cut down even a tree, respect nature. Ask forgiveness first. Then you don't do it without thought. Okay? So that's what to do. Anyway. I am a high school student. I'm addicted to computer games and movies. I would like to give it up. Would you please give me some advice? Many thanks, written by the boy's mother, probably. You know, one of the things with computer games, I shouldn't tell this story, but I'm going to tell this story. I'm getting into trouble for this. But one of the man's friends was addicted to computer games. He wasn't doing well at school. I know truth is really important, but this is a weird case. He wasn't doing well at school, and so he left school. And his mother was really, really upset at him for doing computer games. And he really needed money, so he started a computer game shop. He was so successful, he's got branches all over Australia, he's a multi-billionaire, and now he spends all his time playing computer games. He doesn't need the money, he's a millionaire. But that won't happen to your son. That was a weird case. So in order to stop doing that, you know, you have to see the value in other things. Whatever you put value in is what you're inclined towards. So just stand back from the computer. What are you doing that for? Go and look at other people who play computer games for many, many years. Probably obese, no quality of life. You know, no friends. Just sitting in a room, computer games day and night, not looking after their health. And ask yourself, do I want to be like that? Somehow or other you've got to take away, yeah, there's delight, it's fun doing computer games, but realize it's more to life than that. I know that sometimes you can ask your parents, I'm sure there must be some program you can install on the computer to actually limit the time for playing computer games. So after 2 hours or 3 hours, whatever time you choose, it has to turn off. Can you do that on computers?
Well, yeah. They probably can't get so they can.
Yeah, but I'm sure that if anyone here wants to make a fortune, you can invent a program like that, you know, sort of to limit computer games, an unhackable program or difficult to hack. You do that, sell it to parents, you'll be a multi-millionaire in a few weeks. Because this is a problem which almost every parent has in the world. Yes?
Sorry,
you're saying about the program,
computers. I think that's called parenting.
Here we go, called parenting. You know, if I wasn't a mother, I'd be a millionaire. So he got it for parenting?
Yeah.
Okay, there we go, parenting program. You know, I missed out because I thought of that years ago, but you know, because I'm a monk, you know, if I wasn't a monk, I'd be a multi-billionaire. Steve Jobs would have no chance. Oh, parenting itself. Why do you need a program? It is because... Okay, this is the power button. It is oftentimes because many of your children can outwit you. I don't know where they're learning from. I think they go to school. And they confer with their peers how to outwit your parents. If you could confer with other parents to gang up on your kids, then you'd have an equal level playing field. But they get all the advice from their friends at school, what works and how you can get out of doing these things. That's what I used to do when I went to school. You ask all your friends, you know, my parents said this, how can I get out of doing it? And when you had a large group of people, and someone came up with a solution, and that's what you all practiced, but your poor parents didn't know that. So yeah, parenting, if you are a very skillful parent with lots of time, but look, the fact that this happens again and again and again means, you know, those parenting skills may be not strong enough, you haven't got the time for it. So sometimes you do need other solutions. So maybe if you haven't got the parenting skills, you get a parenting program from some sort of, you know, IT company. Try that out. And if that doesn't work, and I mentioned this to someone today, if it's a boy, it's your son, high school student, actually, probably it's a boy, is find a girlfriend for him. Because when it comes to the computer game or the girl, there's his hormones, he can't resist it. So, but sometimes you say, well, he doesn't need a computer, so I can't find a girl for him. Look, no, find one. I'm sure there's many young girls who could need some cash. So look, now, this is a good cause. You know, this is not sort of prostitution or anything. All it really is, it's just getting my kid now off the computer. So, you know, can you dress up or something, a nice pretty girl, sexy or whatever, hot chick, get her to come, and the boy will just... Boys are led by their mothers, by beautiful girls. It's amazing the power they have on them. It's called girlfriend power. And this was another story which is amazing how this worked. This was not sort of a high school kid, but a university kid. And you know, he was going out with the girls late at night, going to nightclubs, and his grades were going down at university. So much so, he was really in danger of failing and being kicked out of the university. And his mother and father had told him many, many times, but even though they were good parents, some kids are so stubborn they will not listen. But his father was smart. He was actually an ex-lawyer, incredibly smart guy. And I really admire him for how he handled this. He waited up for his son to come back from the nightclub one evening, 1-2 o'clock in the morning, when he came back with his girlfriend. He was waiting outside the house, and he said, come inside, both of you. The boy, his son, was terrified of being embarrassed by his father in front of his girlfriend. But his father was very polite. He didn't speak to his son, he spoke to his son's girlfriend. And the conversation went something like, you know, you've been going out with my son quite a few weeks now. I'm not quite sure what your relationship is with him and how far it's gone, but you don't know that maybe later on, you know, you really want to commit to each other and maybe just go and live with each other, even get married. But when you get married, you know, you want to have someone who's got a reasonable job. I don't know if he's told you, but his grades are going so badly that he's likely to get kicked out of university. And the girl said, I didn't know that. He hasn't been I don't want to live with or marry someone who hasn't finished university. I don't want to be with someone like that. And the father said, I just wanted you to know. Good night. Have a nice night together. And it worked. From that night on, every time they went out, the first thing the girlfriend said, how's your grades? Have you done your assignments? How's it going? And that poor boy, he could resist pressure from his mother and from his father, but he was putty in the hands of his girlfriend. So she made him come back early if he hadn't done his assignments yet. And the poor guy couldn't do anything about it, so he did his assignments, he finished university with a good degree. It's called girlfriend power. With everybody, with every child, they've always got a weak point. It's the leverage point. Find where the leverage, you know, what they really like and how you can actually bend them to your will. It may not be, you know, by telling them directly. But you always got a little way you can lever them. With a boy and a girlfriend. So that way you can, mother and father, don't go directly trying to train or tell your boy what to do. Tell the girl, and he tells the boy. Then it's stuck, you can't do anything about it. Anyway, that went over him anyway. And any other comments or questions about these things? But also, maybe, oh yeah, going in the back. Yeah, well, this is the point. I'm overcommitted, so I'm very careful that if people ask me, can you please come back to Melbourne in November, I will not agree to that, so I'll go and see whether I can. So if I say I can, I will. But I can refuse anybody. I've told many people already that 12 days ago now, I got an invitation from your president of Sri Lanka, President Mahinda Rajapaksa, who's the head of state and also the head of the army, to come the next month, this full moon, the full moon after, post on day, to give the national sort of sermon on post on day in front of TV and do some other talks. You know, this will be all expenses paid, probably business class, to Sri Lanka. You know, another breakfast in his palace where he serves me baked beans. I've been there before. They're really smart because they have protocol officers who find out what you want, what you like. So your president found out I like baked beans. So I don't know where he got them from, but he served me baked beans with his own hand. So I refused. I can't go, I'm busy. I can't overcommit, as you said. So I can refuse a head of state. So, Cora, it's very easy for me to refuse you if I'm committed.
You like that.
Yeah. And you understand that.
Yes.
You know, but I'll see what I can do. My trouble is, I've told quite a few people, is the president of Sri Lanka is the head of an army. He's got enormous power. So any day now, I'm expecting a visit from a secret special forces of Sri Lanka to come to my hut in the middle of the night, and I'll wake up in Colombo the following morning. Because, you know, you don't refuse presidents. But anyway, that's a bit funny, guys. He wouldn't do that. But it's true that sometimes you're forced to break promises because you make them too easily. That's why, you know, that my virtue as a monk, it was hammered into me when I was a young monk. If you make a promise, you have to be able to keep it. And if you can't keep it, then you say no. Or at the very least, you say, look, I'll think about it, maybe I'll see if it's possible. So you have to mean what you say. But if you make promises too easily, especially if you're one of those people who just make promises to please others, because you're too afraid to say no, because you're going to disappoint someone, especially people you care about, then you get overly committed. Now we all know the saying, you should always be prepared to say no. And to encourage that, some people are overcommitted and over busy. Please, you have to accept no for an answer. When you invite somebody to say no, don't argue with them and keep pressuring them. Otherwise, you know, we have this society where everybody is working too much because they've overcommitted because they tried to say no, and the no wasn't accepted. So when someone says no, accept it, they'll come another time. And that's one way we can help others not be overcommitted, as we don't want to be overcommitted. So someone says, can you come to my party? And they say, no, I can't, please. And they start arguing, but you must come, it's really important, we'll miss you, you're so important to us, please come, you have to come. And you get pressed into coming, when you come in, they don't even say hello to you, because no person, 100 or 200 people. You've been there and done that? So please, be kind to other people, realise we're all under great pressure these days. So when being able to say no, and have the no is respected. Okay, does that answer the question, Solomon? Any other questions before we finish off? Yes? Okay, this is called equanimity. And equanimity is where you can't do anything. Unfortunately, there are times when you see somebody suffering, you just can't help them. Now, even when it comes to computer games, I don't really know about computer games, so sometimes you see someone doing that, I don't know what to do, honestly. I give some suggestions, but I don't know if it really works, because that's, you know, not my area. But there are some times when we have to allow people to suffer. It's one of the most difficult things in the world. You see someone coming up to you, they've got some addiction to alcohol or to drugs. You know, this guy who came the other day to our monastery, addicted to heroin. Now for many years, he's basically had his own studio into rock and roll and drugs for years. And he really wanted to get off the heroin. And I was prepared to help him as much as I possibly could. But then he started leaving the monastery, buying it and taking it again. It was so sad for me that it was just too much, I just couldn't do it. And I wasn't powerful enough to help him. So it hurts, you know, when you have equanimity to see when someone destroy themselves. Someone you care about. You can't do much about it. This is one of the reasons why that little saying, very short but very meaningful. I've mentioned it, I think, in the talk this afternoon. It was the saying from the old English Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, 1966. There was a big war on in the Middle East. And a journalist asked the ex-Prime Minister of Britain, what do you think about the problem in the Middle East? He answered immediately, there is no problem in the Middle East. The journalist was stunned. How can he say that? There's a war going on as we speak. People are being blown apart by tank shells, riddled with bullets. These are people with families, with kids. What do you mean there's no problem in the Middle East? And this wise statesman replied, sir, a problem is something with a solution. There is no solution in the Middle East. Therefore, it is not a problem. It's a funny statement, people laugh, but it is so true. A problem is something with a solution. If it's a solution, work on it. It's a problem, do something about it. But many of the things in life have got no solutions at all. And that's where we have to have equanimity. To recognize many things aren't problems because there aren't solutions. So please be effective. You've only got a limited amount of time and energy in your life. Use it efficiently on things which are problems, things which have solutions, so you can make a difference. We waste so much of our energy and time, our hope, and even our kindness on the lost causes. Things which you cannot change. Give it a try. See if you can find a solution. But when you know you can, that's where you have equanimity. Okay? Okay. It's 10 to 10 now. We have some announcements. So Thank you all for coming to these talks, and if you really are hungry for more, remember there is this monk over here, the nuns over there, very wise people, good meditators, good teachers. Go and ask them the questions. And if you're really hungry for my talks, there's over 1,000 of my talks on YouTube. Over 1,000 of them. Everything you can possibly say, usually many times over, you can actually see on those YouTube talks. So if you really are addicted to these types of talks, get on YouTube and listen to them any time you like. And they may be very helpful for you. If not, just wait a few months, probably in November. If not, next May, I'll be back again. Thank you all.
Thank you.